Welcome to the AI and Data-Driven Leadership Podcast, the show where we spotlight the innovators and leaders who are transforming the future using the power of data and AI. I'm your host, Dean Guida, author, podcaster, and founder and CEO of Infogistics and Slingshot. We're living in an exciting era, a time where builders, leaders, and entrepreneurs are using data and AI to fuel unprecedented growth, create groundbreaking products, and drive meaningful transformations in their industry. If you're ready to learn from some of the brightest minds and uncover actionable insight to take your business to the next level, you're in the right place. And if you have a story to share, stick around until the end of the show. We'll tell you how you can become our next guest and inspire leaders around the globe. Welcome to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast. Let's dive in. All right. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. I'm excited to have Danny Nathan here, founder, CEO of Apollo 21, and I love your background. That's very cool. And you know, what you do is you help companies innovate, design products, help with growth strategies, and for a number of companies. But Danny, why don't you go and introduce yourself before we kick this off?
Yeah, sounds great. Thanks for having me, Dean. I'm excited to chat here. My name is Danny Nathan. I am the founder of Apollo 21. I have spent the last 20 plus years working in technology and product development and venture building across anything from very small early stage startups to Fortune 500 organizations and pretty much everything in between. And I founded Apollo 21 about a little shy of 5 years ago now. And we focus effectively on three things. We help companies develop and execute an innovation strategy and help them understand what the cultural and operational impacts of a commitment to innovation might look like and where the growth opportunities are there. And then we help companies build and launch new technologies either for use inside the house to streamline operations, could be anything from AI platform implementation to automations, operational workflow development, things like that. And then we also build technology products that our customers sell to their customers.
Yeah, that's a lot of innovation, a lot of creative thinking. That's
what makes it fun.
Yeah, let's talk about innovation because everyone wants to innovate big and small. What are some of your like high level points of view around a process of innovation? What does it mean? And you talked about culture too. How do you blend culture and into innovation? And maybe just share some thoughts around that.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a few things that are underlying the conversation around innovation. And I think that part of where folks get tripped up when thinking about innovation is the progression. When companies start, they tend to start small. They tend to start in a highly innovative fashion where they are bringing something new to market, developing a new product, looking for an untapped customer base to appeal to and to serve a job to be done for. And then over time, as those companies begin to find product market fit and grow and find success, eventually what we see is that they begin to focus more on efficiency and less on strategy, opportunity, and innovation. And you end up in this sort of tug of war scenario where as companies focus on becoming ever more efficient and wringing every dollar out of every penny that goes in, the innovation muscle, for lack of better terms, atrophies over time. And you get so focused on efficiency and how do you make things work well that you lose sight of the fact that innovation at its heart is highly inefficient. It is quite literally the use of resources to explore the unknown, to experiment with weird ideas that may or may not work. And there is an inherent waste in that process until you find success. And I think that you mentioned culture. Culture to me is one of the biggest predictors and enablers of innovation within an organization. If your organizational culture is focused on efficiency and is focused on making sure that everything runs absolutely as smoothly as possible and that there is no waste in the system, then you are inherently limiting the ability for your team and your organization to throw whatever euphemism you want at it. Think outside the box, try weird things, experiment with new ideas. And so to me, establishing a culture of innovation is establishing a mindset amongst your employees that they do have not only the freedom, but the responsibility to focus on maintaining that experimentation. And you have to enable and give permission for people to embrace the slight waste that comes along with that innovation process in order to give them the opportunity to discover weird new things that might benefit your business.
Yeah, that's great. We're a big believer in experimentation, not just in product, but also like in go-to-market and how to improve growth strategies. And one thing we also, or at least we struggle with, and I think most do, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, is we have all this data, we instrument the app. So we have all this data and it tells us what's happening. But like the big question is why? Like why? Right. And it's so hard to get the why answer. Do you have any thoughts on how to improve the understanding of why something's happening?
I always come back to talk to your customers. At the end of the day, when you're developing a product, you are doing it to solve a job to be done that your customer is hiring that product to accomplish. And I think that a lot of companies focus on the customer engagement early on because they're trying to figure it out. And then as you get further down that sort of spectrum of product market fit, we lose sight of the need to continue talking to customers, which then limits our ability to understand what they're seeing in the market, how things are changing, how changes that are outside of our scope or outside of our product might impact the way that customers view or use our product to continue solving that problem. And sometimes the job that needs to be done changes along the way. And so if you continue to talk to your customers and continue to gather that feedback and to understand why the data is producing, as you said, the inputs or the flags that it's producing, then you have a much higher likelihood to connect the what to the why, the data to the reason that data is being surfaced.
Yeah, so important. Not always easy to do, especially when you get a lot of data. Not everyone wants to talk to you. And then you get friendly customers to talk to you and don't always get like the entire why. But you,
I think, Dean, that segmentation and approaching that customer development process through a very focused lens of what you're trying to learn and not just focusing it on customer surveys or customer feedback, but asking very specific questions. Hey, Judy, our data says that the time customers spend in our application is dropping. Have you found yourself spending less time in the application? Why? Is there something that it isn't doing for you these days? Or have we created a feature that is working so well that you don't need to come back as often? You know, it could be a bad thing and it could be a good thing. And I think that how you go about asking those questions and how you frame the conversation will help customers understand what you're looking for from them and help you avoid the moment of, oh, I'm just talking to a customer, so they're going to rattle on for a while or take up too much time, as opposed to asking very pointed, clear questions that get you the answers that you need.
Yeah, I like that. Now, how about it's hard to find product market fit? And any tips or process or strategies for that? I mean, we've been building software for 36 years, a bunch of commercial products, and we struggle with product market fit. And sometimes we don't, but most of the times we do.
Yeah, I think that finding product market fit is probably one of the absolute hardest aspects of developing any product. And not to sound overly repetitive, but I do continually come back to the idea of talk to your customers because it will give you the lens through which you can understand where your product is falling short. The other thing that, you know, I think a lot of folks don't think about is once a feature is launched, most folks just assume that feature is now ingrained in part of your product, and they don't really take the time to go back and look at it and say, on a feature by feature basis, what's working, what's not, what percentage of our customers are using feature X versus feature Y. And there's a world where, in spite of all of the effort and the research and the development time that went into creating and releasing a new feature, sometimes it makes sense to kill it and to remove that from the product because 10% of your customers are creating 90% of your support tickets related to that feature, and it's creating an outsized resource drain that you could otherwise dedicate elsewhere or figure out some better feature that might serve a broader set of your customers or attract a new customer base.
Yeah, easier said than done. Once the designers and developers and even execs build some feature, it's tough to take it out. But you're right. Everything you said, plus just simplicity and staying core to, as you talk
Yes.
about jobs to be done and these habit loops and just making sure the UX is really fluid and simple. But it's hard to do that. I don't know a lot of teams that could do that, but it's really good to say it and try and do it.
Well, let's also not discount the fact that everything that we're talking about is hard. If innovation were easy, everybody would be
Everything is
doing it
hard.
and doing it well. And if developing new products and wrapping a business around those were easy, we would all be entrepreneurs. Yeah, it's hard, but it's hard because the payoff hopefully is worth it for you.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. So, like, maybe you can comment on the kind of hype around AI. Everything is so elevated. And yes, great time to be building product, amazing things we can solve now. But what the market's being told and what they think, and then the reality is why so many projects are failing. And in some ways, too, like even impacting jobs and workforce. And what are your comments around the hype around AI? And how do you ground it in the company, in a delivery of a product? A generic question there, but.
No, it's a great question and it's very timely. I think that, man, I have lots of thoughts around AI. The hype is real. And I think that the ability for us to get caught in that hype cycle, you look around and everybody is talking about AI. And it's not just tech rags and the places that the nerds amongst us tend to gravitate towards. You can't turn on mass media news these days without seeing some discussion of AI. And so I think the first thing to keep in mind is yes, this change is coming, and you need to be focused on how that change will impact your business. But that doesn't necessarily mean rushing out and deploying AI in some fashion or rushing to get AI into your product for the sake of being able to say to the world that we have AI. The truth of developing any product, regardless of whether or not there is an AI component of it, still comes down to solving that job to be done for somebody. And that somebody could be inside the house, that somebody could be a customer. But figuring out how AI is additive to that process, either by streamlining your workflows internally so that you can serve your customers better, faster, and at a higher quality, or providing your customers with a capability that they wouldn't have otherwise had before AI was a reality, I think is important. As far as why we're seeing so many projects fail, I think that a lot of it comes down again to the hype around it and then the inherent thought that if I'm not doing this now, then I'm already falling behind. And that's a little bit of a double-edged sword because I think that on the one hand, yes, if you are not paying attention to AI today and thinking about how you're going to leverage it in the future, then there is the potential to be left behind. On the other hand, cramming some AI product into your workflow because we need AI probably isn't going to end up solving it for you. What you're likely to end up with is a product that will inevitably be defunct in a year or two, unless you're talking about a ChatGPT or something like that. And even that's going to change. So I think that we're in this really weird middle gray area right now where everybody knows it's coming and can see the potential for the impact that AI will have, but has yet to figure out exactly where the use cases for that technology have the most beneficial impact for their organization and their product in a manner that really presses the fast forward button for them. I think that right now everybody's just throwing stuff at the wall and trying to see what sticks because we don't really know what the full outcome of the shift to AI is going to end up looking like yet.
Yeah, that's a good answer. And have you seen any really interesting, good agentic AI implementations out there?
Nothing that comes to mind that is truly an agentic solution as people are talking about it so far. I think there's a lot of folks that are claiming that things like automation are serving the agentic AI need. And in some ways they are, but they aren't truly an agentic solution. And so I think that we're just scratching the surface of figuring out how companies can implement a truly agentic AI solution that really does solve a problem as opposed to paints automation in a better color.
Yeah, and it's a great theory concept to implement agentic AI, and it can solve a lot of problems. The problem is that the tech implementation doesn't always work. And
Right.
you have these challenges of you can visualize what this great solution will look like, but then getting it to work properly is, people are really working hard on that. But everyone thinks that Oh yeah, I'll just have a thousand agents go build a commercial product and make $1 billion. That's just not where we're at.
No, we're not there yet.
Yeah, and that's where the hype comes in. And I don't know how you feel about that, but it's, yeah, even in software development, yes, AI coding helps us tremendously, but it's not replacing your dev team, and you need your dev team. It's just
Right.
a partner to make them more productive.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point. I think that the expectation that AI is going to replace all of our software engineers is a misnomer today. But at the same time, demanding that software engineers ignore AI is an equally substantive miss. And I think that from what we've seen on projects, the real power of AI today, especially for our engineers, is acting as a paired programmer without having another person there. And so you get the benefit of the shared thought process and the thought partner who can help accelerate the development and can help do some of the rote work for you. In the same way that we see a lot of folks using a ChatGPT or something to write content, it can write code, but you need somebody there who understands what's being written and understands how it fits into the architecture of the system that you're building so that when the output comes out, they have at least some chance of recognizing if there's a mistake, if the outcome that code is producing isn't aligned to what you want or isn't interacting with your data systems correctly, whatever it is. And I think that viewing it as a thought partner today is a stepping stone until we get to the point where AI is smart enough not to need handholding.
Yeah, we do a ton of AI work, and there is so much work you have to do handholding and so much to get things right. And what's your point of view? Do you think that it's about job replacement, or it's a new member on the team, whatever that department's doing, and it's collaborative multiplier of output and productivity?
I think the reality is that it will be a combination of both. I think that there are some tasks that are going to go away and going to be dedicated to machines. And I think that there are some tasks that are going to be better suited in more of a thought partner type of fashion where it is additive and an accelerant, but isn't ready to replace people yet. And so it just depends on what seat you're in within that organization as far as perhaps how scared you need to be today versus a few years from now.
And like when you do if your innovation work must have changed so much. So like first of all, forget about AI, but innovation's hard.
Yes.
But like how would you compare and contrast when you'd go in and talk about innovation and understanding what new problems to solve or jobs to be done as you talk about to now with AI? How has things changed in the world for you?
I think that the assumption that innovation can happen faster and with less effort, in the same way that AI is making people assume that code's going to be written faster, content's going to be written faster, movies are going to be made faster, et cetera, is one of the biggest challenges that we see. The gap between expectation and reality hasn't been made clear for a lot of people that are interested in implementing AI into their business. And so when we start those conversations and we help them understand what innovation might mean to their organization and how it might impact their specific business goals, there's this sort of magic potion moment where they go, we're just going to throw AI at it. And you go, it's similar to what you were saying about software developers. No, we're not quite there yet, where you just flip a switch and say, I want you to go blank and expect that it's going to happen correctly and happen well, but rather that it is a research partner. It's a way to accelerate discovery. It's a way to create thought partnership in the ideation and discovery process so that more ideas hit the table and perhaps experimentation moves faster, but it doesn't replace the need to approach your innovation efforts strategically and with the expectation that it is still going to be hard.
No doubt. So this might not be a fair question, but it's something I've been thinking about.
Ooh,
And I
fire
should
away.
probably just ask the AI, ask ChatGPT to explain it to me. And I haven't even done that. But we talk about open source models and then giving out the weights of everything. I don't get that. Like having open source with the weights, how does that help people?
It's basically giving people access to the training data to help inform the way that the AI model views and reacts to the world and giving people a starting point so that if they are looking to train their own model, they don't have to start from zero, but rather can start from some level of understanding. And it depends on what type of model we're talking about and what the use case for that model is. If you go and look at something like a Hugging Face, where their library has all sorts of models that are trained for all sorts of different things, some of them are very broad, like a large language model akin to a ChatGPT or something like that, where it has been trained on so much broad data that the idea of recreating it is daunting. And we've seen things like DeepSeek come out, and one of the key kind of factors for DeepSeek and the reason that it gained so much notoriety was the speed with which they were able to build it and the access to data that they had to make it happen quickly. But the average person doesn't necessarily have all of that access. And so by open sourcing the models and then helping people understand what the weightings are that dictate the way that model thinks, you're giving them the ability to start on third base and then to play with those weights so that they can learn, oh, if I change this and tell it this, then the outcome changes in this manner. And so you're giving people a head start on developing AI that works for their specific needs.
And then how do you like map the weights to what? So like just having weight, it's like, how do you map it to the use cases and then decision tree?
A lot of that comes down to the individual use case. I'll give you an example. One use case that we've been exploring lately is leveraging an AI model to predict customer churn. And so part of that requires us to go in and say, okay, what does churn mean? Churn is when a customer leaves. Okay, what are the factors that might contribute to churn? And we do this on a business by business basis, because churn for McDonald's might be that somebody started ordering at Wendy's on the regular, but churn for a SaaS company might look entirely different and might be something like usage drops over time, bills start getting paid late because they don't feel like it's important again. And so the weighting then applies value to those different factors in a manner that allows you to say to the model, I think it's more important if a customer's usage drops than if they miss a month, a bill for a month, or pay that bill 2 days late. And you might equally say that, hey, paying a bill 2 days late holds a little bit of weight in the model, but paying it 2 months late holds a lot of weight in the model, because you can begin to attribute different sort of thought processes to why those things are happening.
So then, forgive me, because I haven't looked at this, but then that kind of means there's like this huge question or use case with weights right next to it, right? Because you got very specific, like churn is based on someone paying the bill late. But how do you even find that in an open source model? That must mean you have this huge question weight information or data dictionary, or how does that work?
I think it depends a lot on what the open source model that you're looking at is used for. You're unlikely to take a generalized open source model and start applying it to figuring out churn, for example, because to your point, the things that it's trained on have little to no relevance to the factors that might define churn. And if that's what you're looking to accomplish, you would need to look for some sort of open source model that has a notion of what churn is. And the closer to a churn model you can get when you're searching for that open source data set, the more likely it is to align to the factors that you are interested in weighting for yourself. And so if what you can find is a generalized SaaS business metrics model that happens to mention churn, it may not be as good as somebody who has already taken the time and said, I have created a predictive model for churn that weights X, Y, and Z. And if you're going to use that, then all you have to do is go in and say, oh, you're weighting X, Y, and Z is 1, 2, and 3. I think it should be 2, 3, 1, something like that. And so you have to start from an open source model that has at least some notion of alignment to what you're trying to output from it.
And do you think, I mean, we've seen historically how mindshare adoption of open sources, what do you think the future of who's going to win? Is it going to be the open source models, or is it going to be the private models, or do you have any thoughts there?
I think that the big companies that we're seeing that are developing the base models that a lot of us use today, Google's got Gemini, Anthropic's got Claude, OpenAI is ChatGPT, et cetera. I think that those guys are still going to remain major players because they have so much ingrained market share, either in AI in the case of Claude and ChatGPT, or generalized market share and consumer confidence a la Google, that people will readily pick those things up and use them. I think that over time, however, open source models will provide us the foundation for some of the more explicit and directed models that we're talking about, something to predict churn or something that is far more unique than those generalized LLMs. And over time, I think we will see a shift towards more specificity in modeling and use cases that rely on very specific models for very specific use cases, because something like a ChatGPT just isn't suited to the needs of that kind of specificity.
What are your thoughts? I'll say all software companies are running to add AI capabilities into their product. With the more and more useful and more capabilities, you're driving up cost of goods, you're driving up a bill. And where do you think that's going to go? Do you think that it's going to be a high percentage of that software companies what you're paying to these models, or think it's going to come down? And or like, how's that going to all play out? I feel like everyone's just racing, and then 5 years from now, we're going to look at our P&Ls and be like, man, we're just resellers of some model.
It depends a lot on how you're implementing whatever that solution is. If what you're doing is wrapping some sort of functionality around a ChatGPT API, then yes, you are going to continue to be beholden to them, excuse me, for costs and for usage. Whereas I think that as companies begin to become more adept at developing their own capabilities in AI, that they will be able to have greater control over when and where that AI model gets used in terms of the use cases for their product. And I think that the processing and the tokenization costs are going to continue dropping. We've already seen them fall dramatically over the last couple of years. Eventually, I won't say it's going to go to zero, but it's going to go to near zero, where the computational cost isn't as much of the problem. Things like the power usage costs, which we probably don't see when it's driven that far down the line, are going to come into play and may impact pricing. And we've seen a lot of commentary lately around how giant data centers to support AI are costing a lot of money in new areas and are using a ton of power resources in those areas, to the point where we're probably going to see regulation around that soon and some sort of definition around who gets what in terms of the power usage. And so I think that we'll see some impact there, but I think it'll get cheaper over time, and the use cases eventually will dictate who's paying for what where.
Yeah. I know our AI bill is just going up all over the place. It's just not stopping with everyone trying different things and expensing it. And then our own purchases of AI and coding AI tools and everything's just going up, up. But yeah, people have to watch out for that and be very intentional about where they're investing.
Yeah, and I think part of that, Dean, comes down to a lot of the AI platforms and services today are being sold on a SaaS basis. They're adhering to the known pricing model of I pay a subscription to get a thing and I use that thing for whatever period of time. And we've seen across the board, regardless of whether it's AI focused or not, SaaS costs at companies are skyrocketing. Every day we turn around and, oh, that's a cool little tool that I could make use of today, $10 a month. Oh, that's another cool tool, $50 a month. And you turn around and all of a sudden, like you said, your costs are through the roof because you're using 17 different AI or different SaaS tools.
Yep, no doubt. And what's your view on form factor? Again, with all the hype out here, they're trying to attack Apple and others. Oh, it's not going to be the phone in the future. And what are your thoughts about what's the future look like for interface and form factors?
I think that we're going to use our hands a lot less and our voices a lot more. I think that the idea of talking to computers and the idea that machines are observing the world around us in much the same way that we observe the world around us, but with the capability of recording and documenting and reacting to that, eventually it's going to be less focused on mouse and keyboard and much more focused on, no, I meant this. What if we try it in blue? Things like that. And we're just going to see things reacting to us in the early days on a screen and in later days, I don't know, projected on glasses in front of us or whatever it might be.
Yeah, really. I have like Meta glasses, and I have a prescription there, and I love it. I listen to music a lot because no one even knows you're listening to music with your glasses on, but you can still have conversations and see everything around you. And then I know Meta just came out with their display glasses. I want to get a pair. Have you tried them? Because it
I
projects.
haven't had the opportunity yet, no.
Yeah, it projects a display on your lens, and yeah. So yeah, I was curious how if you had any experience with any of those.
Unfortunately, I don't yet, but I'm looking forward to the
Yeah.
opportunity to find one and give it a shot.
Now, what I gotta ask you, Apollo. I love that. Like, what's the meaning behind Apollo? And why 21?
When I was naming the company, I was thinking about things like moonshots and some of the startup parlance that we're all used to. And I happened to be watching some space-oriented show at the time. And I can't remember what it was, but those two things got caught in my head. And I started digging around into the history of the Apollo program and discovered that Apollo 21 would have been the next subsequent Apollo mission had they all followed through and flown. I believe 18 was actually the last Apollo mission that flew. They had 19 and 20 that were scheduled and they got canceled due to budget issues. And so I liked the idea that we as an organization are helping you take your moonshot, that we're helping you get back to the moon. And the fact that we launched in 2021 was just a nice alignment there as well.
Yeah, I like that. Good story.
Thank
Now,
you.
was there a question I didn't ask that you like, oh, I really want to share this with the audience?
I ask folks the same question on my podcast, and now I'm seeing what it feels like on the other side of the table.
Yeah, you picked out something clever.
Yeah, I should have had something at the ready for this, but I think the thing that I'll throw out there, and I get asked this a lot, is just what is your general advice? My general advice for anybody who is trying to innovate is to be prepared for failure and to rethink your relationship with the idea of failure. This is something that I've spent a lot of my career doing and thinking about to the point where it has led to a bit of a personal mantra, which is fail beautifully. And for me, fail beautifully is a reminder that anything that is worth doing is worth giving your all, and that failure is an inevitable part of growth. And the more you can see failure as a learning experience and a growth opportunity instead of a negative, like it has been beaten into us from an early age. In school, if you fail, it's bad. You fail the class, you get held back, whatever. And in reality, as an adult, once you get out into the world, failure isn't necessarily bad. It's just a way to learn and move forward. And to me, that kind of mental shift is really important, especially for anybody who is in innovation and entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I love that. You're 100% in innovation entrepreneurship. I wish we had a different word than fail. I personally don't like fail fast because just fail is a bad word. And it's really about learning and experimenting, like what you're saying. And maybe you can help come up with a new word out there because it's not failure. It's no, we're in inventing and we're on our journey to the beautiful solution.
Yeah, maybe a better way to put it would be hypothesize everything.
Yeah, I like that.
Because then it's focused on the idea that you're learning. And if your hypothesis is disproven, it's not necessarily a failure. You've just learned what didn't work.
Yeah, love it. Love it. Danny, we'll really appreciate the conversation. And if the audience wants to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
Easiest three places are Apollo 21, so apollo21.io. I have a newsletter and a podcast that's somewhere over here called Innovate, Disrupt, or Die. And that lives at innovatedisruptordie.com. And then you can always find me on LinkedIn and feel free to give me a shout.
Awesome. Thank you, Danny. Thanks for taking the time and sharing your thoughts.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hey, it's Dean Guida here. Thank you so much for tuning in to the AI Data Driven Leadership Podcast, where we showcase the visionaries who are shaping the future with data and AI. If you're a successful leader, entrepreneur, or business professional and want to share your story on this program, we'd love to hear from you. Visit us at podcast.slingshotapp.io to apply. Got something value out of this interview? Share the love. Take a quick screenshot, post it to your favorite social platform, or text it to a friend. Don't forget to tag the show and use the hashtag AI Data Driven Leadership. I love seeing your posts and suggestions for future guests. And if you know someone who would make a great guest, let them know about the show. We're dropping new episodes regularly, so don't miss out. Hit subscribe wherever you listen. And if you enjoyed this episode, a quick thumbs up, rating, or review would mean the world to me and my team. Want to stay connected? Visit our website at podcast.slingshotapp.io or find me on LinkedIn at Dean Guida and Instagram at Dean Guida 89. Thanks again for listening to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast. We'll see you next time.